Welcome, listeners, to the Lazy Project Manager podcast. My name is Peter Taylor, known as the Lazy Project Manager, and it's been a while, hasn't it? I've been busy. It's just a lot been going on in life. So it's been a couple of months before or since we had our last podcast together, and so hopefully you haven't forgotten all about me and you still remember that the Lazy Project Manager is out there. Okay, so we're back. It is now March the 1st. It is, it's a white winter wonderland out the window right now. It is snowing hard. It's, relative for England, it's a lot of snow that we've been having. So I'm cozy and warm inside, and I'm talking to you all today on this, the 184th Lazy Project Manager podcast. Wow, how did that happen? It'll soon be 200, and I need to start thinking about what I'm going to do for the 200th episode, I think. It should be a bit of a celebration. But anyway, right now, what I've got in this particular podcast, we have two interviews. I have an interview with a gentleman called Patrick Gleason, who's written a book called Working with Coders. And I have an interview with a gentleman called Chris Cook, who's also called the Entrepreneurial Project Manager. So you're going to be hearing from those two gentlemen. And I thought I'd kind of bring you up to date with what's going on with me and stuff like that. So it's been fairly quiet because I've joined a new organisation. I'm now working as head of the global PMO for a company called Aptos Retail. And it's exciting. It's an exciting journey. Aptos is based in the UK. It's also based in Atlanta and the US, and it's based in Montreal in Canada, and I've been to all of those locations so far, meeting people, getting to know what great things they've got already, and looking at how we can develop, or I can develop with my team, a global PMO roadmap over the next 12 to 18 months to kind of take things to the level. So that has kind of kept me busy. Another reason why I haven't really been writing or particularly, but I am back now. And actually, this is kind of opportune because I've just released a blog as well. Yeah, I really am back in the productive process, if you like. And the title of the blog is Mentoring the Next Generation, and I'm going to cover that in the interview. So I'm going to kick off now with an interview with Patrick Gleason, and let's hear what he has to say all about his new book. So welcome, a gentleman called Patrick Gleason, who's been a coder and a manager of coders for the past 10 years. He has worked in organizations ranging from bespoke software consultancies to multinational corporations to tiny startups, which I think is just much covers the whole range. And he's currently CTO, Chief Technical Officer of ThinkSmart, a company that provides tools to help young people make better career choices, which in itself is very interesting. So Patrick, welcome to the Lazy Project Manager podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
All right. So we got connected because you've written a book. So congratulations on being a published author. And the book is called, tell the listeners.
It's called Working with Coders, a guide to software development for the perplexed non-techie.
Right, and that's the bit that got me. You know, working with coders, yeah, fine, I've worked with coders, and a guide to software development, yes, I've done all that. Perplexed non-techie, I like that. That's definitely the hook that got me. So well done for putting that in the subtitle. So how did the book come about, and maybe tell the listeners, you know, kind of what drove you to write a book. So, you know, what's the history to it, and how did you manage to get a deal to publish, and you know, what made you want to be an author even?
Well, I think what happened was I found myself having quite a lot of the same thoughts kept on bouncing around my brain. This was a result of having spent quite a long time working in the world of software, and in particular working at, I suppose, the intersection between the software teams and the rest of the business that they were working with, and often seeing firsthand the difficulties in communication and collaboration between coders and their non-technical colleagues, often myself being the cause of the communication and collaboration problems. And over time, I realized that I suppose I'd come up with quite a few opinions based on hard-won experience, And these ideas were just stuck in my brain, and I realized I'd have to do something to let them out. So I thought, well, maybe actually I've reached the point where I could write a book that other people in the sorts of positions that I found myself in would find useful. And it's all very well, obviously, thinking that you're going to write a book. But just on the off chance, I sent an email to the good folks at A Press, who are quite a big publisher of some very technical books, and some slightly more general business books, just outlining the sort of thing I wanted to write. And to my absolute amazement, they got back to me and said, sort of, yes, that sounds good. Do you want to work up a formal proposal? And so, in a state of minor shell shock, I did. And they said, okay, that's great. Get writing. And so it was decided then that I was going to write a book.
Brilliant, brilliant. And I think that's a lesson for people out there because, I met someone who, and I meet quite a few people when I speak, and I've kind of done 18 books now, etc. And people often ask me questions about writing, and so many people, in particular one gentleman who's kind of been procrastinating about doing anything at all, just had this explosive idea in his head. Now, I have no idea whether he can write. I had no idea whether it was a good book or not. But my point to him was, well, if you don't go and try, if you don't contact some of these, publication out public publishers, and you can also do self-publishing, you'll just never know. So, well done for doing that. And and as you found out yourself, they said yes.
No, I think it's very important to just see, because great things can come of it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And as I look, as we speak, if I'm looking at Amazon.co.uk, your book, Working with Coders, is currently number 57 in the Books Computers Internet Certification ranks. It's number 85 in Computer Science Programming, Software Design Testing, Functional Programming, and Software Architecture. It's number 86, so doing quite well. And overall, and I, the, you, people have to understand how many books are out there. It's the Amazon's best-selling rank of 60,020, which is really good, actually. So,
Yeah, it's that number fluctuates quite a
yes.
lot, and I'm always happy when I'm in the top 100,000.
Yes. Yeah, I learned that earlier on because when the latest project manager came out, I started tracking well, I mean, almost on an hourly basis to start with. But it does. You realize that just a few sales can move things around enormously. So, yeah, it's crazy. So, well done. And how long did it take you to write the book?
Let's see. So I started it in sort of September, and I finished it the following May, I suppose. The main issue I had in writing was that at the start of December, my first child was born. And so perhaps as you can imagine, December was not a very productive month bookwise. I had some other things on my plate. But yes, the rest of the time it worked quite well because I was working relatively close to home, but every day I had a bus ride, and I live in London, so these are double-decker buses, and I could get on the bus, go up to the top deck where there was always a seat, and on my commute, I'd have 20 to 30 minutes. At the beginning and end of each day, which I just said, okay, I'm going to do nothing but write, and so I could use my commute to get quite a lot done, which is nice because otherwise that's sort of dead time.
Yeah. Okay.
But certainly the schedule set by the contract by the publishers was pretty brisk, so I sort of it was actually quite liberating because I knew I had limited time. So I couldn't afford to overthink the first draft. I just had to bash the words out,
Yeah.
which was very helpful because it meant that I actually got the bulk of the content written, and I could then go back and try to sort of shape it into something that made consistent sense as a whole.
Yeah, very good. And as you pointed out, with the big event in your life, the dedication is for Sylvia, who next to whose crib much of this is written. So yeah, excellent. All right, so let's get on to we kind of talked about writing, getting the opportunity to write the book and kind of writing experience. So, all right, let's get to the heart. What's so special about coders? Why do we have to treat them differently?
So this I have to answer quite carefully.
I'm sure you do.
I'm tempted to put it like this. Actually, there is nothing special about coders, and that's one of the first big misconceptions that a lot of people make. One of my constant refrains in my daily life and also in the book is that coders are just people, and I think there's a tendency to treat software developers as a different species, and I don't think that's very helpful. But there is something very special about the process of coding, in that software development is about employing a particular mode of very abstract thinking. And the thing is, if you're employing this mode of thinking whilst working on a project, it means that you will view this project from a very different perspective to everyone else who's involved. If I'm building a website, then I spend almost no time looking at what the user of the website will see. And I spend almost all of my time looking at lines of computer code, and thinking about how those lines of computer code interact with each other. Which means that when I'm writing code, I really struggle to think about the end product as other people will see it. I think about what the end product of the written code will look like. And this huge difference in perspective, I think, is the cause of a tremendous number of communication difficulties. It's the root cause why a lot of people find working with code is very difficult. And the role of a good project manager is to be almost the communication conduit, who translates very rapidly at times between the perspective of someone who's writing code and everyone else who isn't.
Got it. And one of the things I talk about is a concept of the visibility of purpose, which I think kind of lends itself a little bit to this. It's like when you put a team together for a project, and there can be some remote resources, there can be coders, there could be subject matter experts in various parts of the world. Unless you articulate what it is you're trying to deliver to the customer, to the end recipients of this solution, whatever it may be, people get very locked down in their own little worlds and don't really necessarily understand. And one of the examples I use is on a project that actually was used in the NHS, the output. But when you got down the multi layers of people working on this, you could quickly find people, in this case, working in our third party offshore organization, who had no concepts beyond the little bit of development work they were doing about what this was going to be used for. And so that visibility of purpose was utterly lost, and therefore their priorities and their kind of consciousness of working on it was completely absent.
I think that term visibility of purpose, I think that describes very well what I'm guessing at, that it's very easy to lose sight of that if you've got your head in code, and as you say, articulating that at the start and making sure that it is kept in mind over the entire course of the project is a hugely important function that the project manager can fulfill.
Absolutely. So you state in the book that writing software is absolutely not like building a house. So can you explain what you mean by that?
Sure. Okay. So full disclosure, I've never personally built a house, and I suspect that some of your listeners who are in the world of construction in particular will pick me up on massively oversimplifying the construction process, because the way I tend to describe it is that when you're trying to build a house, there are two steps. The first step is you decide what you want to build, and the second step is you build it. If you take that as your starting point, software development has already diverged from that process because when you're writing software, you never exactly know what you're going to end up building before you start. And the reason for this is that when you're building software, actually what you're building is something to facilitate a process. And we as human beings, whilst we're pretty good at imagining physical things like buildings, we're really terrible at imagining processes. And so whatever it is, however it is that we think the process will work when we first get started, we always find when we get into it that actually things are a little bit different. And so the software needs to do something slightly different to what we expected. So there's never, when you're writing software, a reliable blueprint that you can start from. We always wish there was, but the reality is that it's always a process of discovery. And then the other really infuriating thing about writing software is that the mathematics of how long something will take just doesn't work very well. When you're building a house, broadly, you can say that if you add more people, you can reduce the amount of time that building the house will take. For in certain ways, there are certain tasks where you can say, okay, if we put two people on this, it'll get done sort of twice as fast. And that again, that never happens in the world of software development, because writing software is about building up a sort of a quite complex conceptual model. And for multiple people to collaborate on this, you need very, very good communication, and you spend a lot of time trying to communicate between the developers so that they all understand what is this rather abstract, almost imaginary thing that they are building through writing code. And the more people you add, the exponentially more complex that communication bit gets, which means that that it's really challenging to get a large team to function effectively in the first place. And it's also really hard to work out how you can allocate resources as time goes on in order to do things quickly and efficiently. So this idea of being able to make a plan to build a house where you know what you're going to build and how long it will take to build it just doesn't really make sense when it comes to software.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. And also, when I went through the book, I love chapter 10, I think is one of my favorite ones, where you speak about when it all goes wrong and
Oh, yes.
you proudly declare yourself a pessimist, a cynic, and a glass half empty guy. Someone get that a drink, that guy a drink straight away. I like realism. I think it's one of the most important things in books, actually. I really don't like books that offer up pure theoretical perfection. But it sounds like you have some tough life experiences with regards to coding and coders. Is that correct?
I'd say yes, but I'd also say that sadly, probably not much tougher than most people who spend a few years in the sort of world that I've moved in. There have been the death march projects where you've realized you've got an impossible task and there's no way of doing it properly, but ridiculous deadlines have had to be imposed by commercial constraints. There have been the utter failures of communication where you realize that what you've spent months working on wasn't what was needed in the first place. There have been those projects where from the outset you realize that money is just going to pour into this endless black hole as some huge change management process that requires some supporting software is just far too big to succeed. And you realize that the next few months of your life are going to be sheer misery as steering committee after steering committee gets more and more heated and more budget arguments break out. But that's just, if I'm honest, I don't know many people in this world who haven't experienced all of these things. So I probably can't complain too much.
Well, no, but it's an interesting chapter anyway. Absolutely. Has writing the book led you on to any interesting things? Apart from this podcast interview, of course. But I mean, has anything come your way, or did you intend anything to come your way by writing the book?
I mean, clearly this podcast interview is the number one highlight.
Oh, bless you.
Certainly, I don't think I wrote the book with the intention of it radically transforming my career, that you know, I would instantaneously become a thought leader with a capital T. But certainly, it spurred some interesting conversations with some people who I wouldn't have otherwise maybe had a chance to talk to. But I think for me, the biggest thing that's come out of it is that the process of writing it has cemented my confidence that I do know now slightly more than I did when I was first starting out. That writing these things down has made me realize sort of, oh yeah, I've got the hang of some of this. And that led to, for example, having the confidence to take my current role, which is as a CTO for admittedly a very small startup. But I thought, well, actually, you know what, I might as well take the plunge, because I'm probably as ready as I'll ever be to be in a position where I need to take the big decisions and manage the process from end to end. Because writing this book has just proven that actually I do think that I know enough, you know, not to know all the answers and guess it all right, but to at least know some of the pitfalls to avoid.
Yeah, got it. All right, perfect. Thank you very much. So, and I'm gonna go and draw on this one because, looking at your bio on Amazon, the last line, it talks about you once spent a year building animatronic puppets as part of a robot circus, including a mechanical octopus that played the xylophone. Well, that's unusual. That's a dinner party conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I won a small grant from Deutsche Bank that was designed to enable people to set up businesses or launch their careers in creative industries. And I won it by pitching this idea of animatronics and creating a robot circus, which obviously it had the benefit of catching the judges' attention. What I hadn't really reckoned on is that it turns out animatronics it's quite hard, and I'd never done any of it before. So when I got some money and I locked myself in a shed to try to put together some prototypes, so that I could then pitch the show to some producers. What I discovered is that I didn't necessarily have the technical expertise to pull it off. So eventually, I managed to get this mechanical octopus that did just about play the xylophone, but in such an unreliable way that I began to realize why the large scale shows that rely on animatronics tend to have budgets of millions of pounds. So I wasn't going to get very far with it with a few grand. But it's still that some of the puppets are still sort of in a shed somewhere in the home counties. So I still dream of one day resurrecting the robot circus if I ever get the chance.
Perfect. Well, there you go. I think it's a wonderful claim to fame and a great conversational topic. So thanks for that. So, Patrick, how can people find out more about you and the book?
The best place to start is probably my tech blog. It's boffinism.com. And that's got various links to more about me and links to how you can buy the book on Amazon in both the UK and the US.
Perfect, perfect. So we've been talking to Patrick Gleason. It's Working with Coders, a guide to software development for the perplexed and non-techie. It's brilliant. I'm just loving this. One of the reviews on Amazon is so useful that I bought three copies. I mean, what more do you want than that? So useful, I bought three copies. The book itself is out there, and as I said, it's doing very well. I mean, it's in the sheer scale of millions of books that are actually produced on an annual basis, it seems it's number 60,000 in the Amazon charts. And by comparison, I've only got one book that's actually selling better than that right now, and that's my book, The Project Manager Who Smiled, and that's at 46,973 in the chart. So there you go. Congratulations, Patrick. I appreciate your time today, and I hope people go and check out the book and find out a lot more about you and what you do, and get to work with coders in a more effective way.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure to chat to you.
All right, thank you. There you go. Interview number one, Patrick Gleason, working with coders. So thank you, Patrick, for your time. As I said, I kind of also started writing as well, which is great. It's been a while. And the title of the blog I put out is Mentoring the Next Generation. And it was one of those moments I was thinking I really should get writing again and get some blogs out there on the big wide web of wonderment. But I couldn't think what to write about or say or anything. And then suddenly, wham, I get a message through my website contact form, and the website is of course www.thelazyprojectmanager.com, and there's a contact form on there if you want to reach out to me. But this one that came through said, I would like to share my knowledge to the next generation of project managers, and basically asked for any guidance or advice in doing so. Serendipitous, I thought, or what? Well, I think it was personally, because and so I began to look at this in a little bit more detail. Now, if you think about it, mentoring is a long-term relationship where the focus is on supporting the professional growth and business development of the recipient, the less experienced partner in the mentoring relationship, the mentee, as it's officially known. The mentor should be a source of wisdom, of teaching, of support, and therefore real-world experience is a must. You have to put in the time and had the personal experience of the good, the bad, and the ugly of project life in order to be a good mentor, I believe. And the mentor is someone who observes, discusses, considers current behaviour and issues, and gently guides changes for the better where needed. Again, this is a call for a certain type of individual. We are not all cut out to be mentor material. But let's just say that you are the right stuff, and you do have some time to mentor others. How would you go about it? At this point, I would offer up not a call to action, but at least a call to comment to listeners of this podcast, readers of the blog. You can go and find it on LinkedIn, on WordPress, on projectmanagement.com. Some kind of input, really. How would you suggest someone with the experience and the interest and the time and a general inclination to go about becoming a mentor? How would they do it? What is your advice? Have you done it yourselves? Have you gained from that experience? Have you learned something from being a mentor? Have you learned something from being a mentee? I hope you certainly have. I look for your comment and input. And whilst I wait patiently for such input and general wisdom, let me consider these questions, or let me help you consider these questions. Why do you want to be a mentor? I mean, there's two reasons. There's altruism or profit. That is, do you want to just give back and it's all free and open, or do you want to profit financially from the effort? I mean, it is possible, both. Both can be true, of course. You could want to give back and also do it for profit, or you just give back freely because you feel you want to, and both are fine. As long as I think you're very clear on that in your own mind and clear to anybody that you engage as a mentee. Well, one or many is the next question. Do you want to offer a one-to-one mentorship engagement for just a lucky individual? Or do you want to offer a larger, more mass-gathering type of mentoring program? Or perhaps something in between? Again, think about it. And what style of mentorship are you thinking of offering? Is it face-to-face? Is it remote? Is it virtual? Is it online? Okay, you have to think these things through. And how long are you committing for? What is your personal timeline of dedication to this program and or each individual? You know, you can't just start this and give up on it. You kind of have to keep going. But in your mind, you need to kind of set expectations. It's going to be 4, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, 2 years. I mean, I don't know. It's up to you. But you need to have that in your mind. And how will you set expectations amongst your mentees or singular mentee? What is truly in it for them, especially if you're asking for money, I think. If this is a financial engagement, they have to be very clear on what they're getting. You know, I spoke some time ago in an article entitled Green Bean Project Management about three things that any newbie would benefit from, and this included finding a mentor. So there is a real need out there for smart, experienced people to give back to the profession in some way. And what I said in that article was give them a safe place to start. So this is the new project manager. You need to give them a safe place to start. Projects are, by their very nature, tricky beasts. And for a newbie to learn the practical skills of project management, we should ensure that they enter the PM world in a controlled way. I mean, hopefully being handed a new project to lead and being told to get on with it, as I was when I became a project manager, is long gone. Rather, we should allow the green beans to experience project reality by taking up a small part in another project manager's project and watching, learning, getting involved in a small way. In addition, there may be project reviews or health checks or retrospectives taking place, and I really hope there are, then this is another great entry experience for the young ones to see and learn. Another safe or safer environment might be internal projects rather than external customer-facing ones, if that's your particular world. The key is to make the environment of learning a safe one. So that's the first thing. The second thing is give them a friendly place to work. Where should they work and report when they first start out? Well, don't leave them out in the cold and without peers or project professionals to help them. If you have a project practice, this is the place to nurture those green beans. Make it easy for them to ask questions that we'll need to ask, and make it easy for them to see experienced project managers in action. We all know that there is a world of difference between theory and practice, and give them support they need to move away from the theory. Key is to make it easy for them to find out all the stuff that they need to find out. And the third one is coming back to the topic of this subject, if you like, is give them a helping hand. Appoint a mentor or find a mentor from out there in project management land who will be there to listen to them from time to time, gently point them in the right direction when they need help. Such a person is invaluable to the beans in their early days of being a project manager or would-be project manager. Encourage them to make the effort to look outside of your own organization and connect to some truly wonderful project managers and experts out there on the World Wide Web of Wonderment. There is a huge amount of advice and guidance through local project management groups, conferences, meetings, online discussion, blogs, and lots more. It may be in this area the green ones might have the upper hand on us grey ones, since this whole social connectivity is second nature to them. But don't forget it, it's out there. The key here is to build the best possible network for now and the future, and to use it wisely. So, you know, that was what I was, you know, I was thank you to my website visitor for triggering this blog and this podcast content. And the subsequent conversation, which I hope we will have. And thank you to all of my lovely listeners and readers for sharing your ideas, thoughts, suggestions, experiences, and general wisdom with regards to the value of mentorship and the path to becoming a mentor. I really do hope that you can contribute. And if we get enough, I might well pick this up on a future podcast and revisit it with some further tips and techniques and ideas. So that's kind of what I wanted to say there. I'm going to stop now. We're going to move on to the second interview for this podcast. This is with a gentleman who calls himself the Entrepreneurial Project Manager. It's Chris Cook. Let's go and listen to what Chris has to say. Oh, hi there. So welcome. I have another guest, and it's Chris Cook. Chris, well, over the past 10 years, Chris Cook has spent his career in the construction industry, which makes it really interesting from my point of view, because it's one industry I've never had anything to do with. I've managed or project managed across many industries, but not construction industry. He has a Bachelor of Science in Industrial Technology Management, with an emphasis in building construction management, and a Masters of Science in Project Management. He is an accredited PMP. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, great. So tell people, where are you in the world?
I am in Denver, Colorado, about a half hour south of Denver, Colorado.
Very nice. And I'm speaking to you from England, where it's actually snowing and very cold. So I don't know what it's like with you.
It's about 40 and sunny.
Yeah, okay. Well, there we go. There we go. Chris wins, definitely. All right. So, well, we're talking about the book, The Entrepreneurial Project Manager. Congratulations. I always say this to people. Congratulations on being a published author. Well done.
Thank you very much.
And actually, you're with one of my publishers. So this book was it's part of the Taylor & Francis group, and my PMO books and social project management books are published by what was Gower, which is now part of the Taylor Francis empire. So we're kind of co-authors in the big organization. So how did the book come about?
So in my capstone course, which was the final course for the master's in project management, the professor, her name is Dr. Ginger Levin.
Uh-huh.
So we had weekly summaries, kind of updating her in terms of how the project's going, giving her, you know, trials and tribulations, things are going well, things are going poorly. And through the course of that, she mentioned, that you're kind of a good writer. Would you be interested in writing a book? to which, to my surprise, because I had never thought about writing a book, it was never really an option in my mind. I immediately jumped at the chance, and she had a relationship with CRC Press. She's written quite a few books with them, so I think her relationship with them jump-started my current relationship with them, and kind of went from there.
Okay, so, well, in this case, it's both a combination of what you know and who you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I did reach out to them. She said, are you interested in this? And I, again, immediately jumped at the chance, just thinking, yeah, and didn't know how to write a book, didn't know really where to start, but I'll figure it out as time goes on.
Yeah, fine. Well, that kind of works. It kind of works. Sometimes it's better just to get going. So, all right. Well done. It's the book's out there. So let's talk about the book. Okay. So that was the connection. Was there a particular reason you wanted to write it, or was there something sort of? Was it just a this opportunity came along, so why not?
As she mentioned it, it was. I immediately started looking around, kind of looking for. Waste. I was working for a large company, so it was, I think, 5,000 total employees.
Mm-hmm.
So it was something that was kind of, all right, now that I've been offered the opportunity to write a book, let's kind of see what I want to write it on. And the construction industry is very experience-based. And with me being so young, and going sort of the academic route with a master's and the PMP and sort of tackling that side of things, I was getting kind of frustrated with career progress. So just taking a look, and then the company's way of managing projects was throwing more management at it. So instead of, I guess, taking a creative approach and trying to do more with less or cutting the fat of the operation, it was a very, we'll just hire more people, or we'll take someone from this division and put them in that division, or it just seemed like a lot of waste was there. So that kind of kick-started my, how would I approach this in this situation? That's kind of where I came from writing it. Also seeing project managers being very busy, and my role was sort of to help them. And in asking for help, they were very reluctant, kind of, I wanted to take things off of their plate, and they were hesitant to do that. I don't know if they're just kind of used to it or going, through their daily motions, and it was difficult for them to give that up. So kind of exploring that side of things as well.
Okay. And I guess the title, I'm going to lead to the title. I mean, how did you become the entrepreneurial project manager?
Gave myself that title.
Well, why not? I call myself a lazy project manager. It kind of worked. So, why not?
Just really reading books by Tim Ferriss and Ryan Holiday. It was the 4-hour work week that kind of got my entrepreneurial spirit jump started.
Uh-huh.
A job that I had, I feel, in Tim Ferriss's book, he mentions virtual assistants. And I think that my job that I was hired to do could have been easily done by one of them. So just seeing these creative approaches taken towards, if someone needs help, and different approaches to getting that besides hiring a full-time, part-time position employee. And this was also my first introduction to the 80-20 principle,
mm-hmm.
which I have now fallen in love with in terms of its power and capabilities and different ways for it to, its different applications. So kind of seeing, bigger isn't necessarily better, more quantity, quality over quantity kind of thing. Where I think a lot of the companies I was being introduced to were steadfast on having quantity.
Mm, yeah. Okay. So what's the book all about? Is it easy to summarize what you were trying to pitch or what you're trying to deliver through the book?
So I was really focused on mindsets more than tactics and specifics, rather than giving someone a, this is how I write things up or how I report things. It was more of a mindset shift, asking better questions to get better answers. One way I found to enter sort of these mindset shifts is through Stoicism and Taoism. Kind of picked those philosophies as I was reading Ryan Holiday's big on the Stoicism side. And I kind of wanted an East-West, balance of philosophies to kind of, give one side of the world versus the other side of the world and how, they may have different but similar.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So,
the obstacle is the way is kind of one of the things I think is important for any progress, where we all kind of run into certain log jams or hurdles. So Stoicism provides a way to do that, and Taoism also kind of gives their take on it, both kind of coming to the same conclusion that impediment to action advances the action. It's kind of the Stoic way, and a Taoist way is the bright way appears to be dark. So again, kind of these contrasting philosophies yet coming to similar conclusions.
Okay, but it's kind of it's very different for the world of project management to kind of have that. So why don't we just drop down into the book itself, and there's a couple of chapters I want to talk about. So chapter 6, it has the very intriguing title of Entrepreneurial Agile Management. That's quite a title. So, what do you mean by that, and how does anyone get to be that sort of manager?
So for me, it's really it goes back to asking the better questions to get better results. So you have the the phases, the milestones, the gates, whatever your sprint session kind of comes from. And in order to become one, I used Michael Matrako's Thinker Toys. It's a fantastic resource for anyone looking to problem solve and approach problems from, I think there's over 100 different ways that he kind of expresses different ways to look at problems. So the one I chose for this part to ask better questions is his Scamper method. And it's a kind of, to go over it quickly for the audience, it's an acronym. So the S is kind of what can I substitute, replace or change parts. The C is, again, combined with other activities, what other ideas and parts can be combined. So really just taking each of these opportunities to look at what you're trying to do and where you're going, and sitting down and not only taking the notes from the owner client or whoever you may be doing the work for, and kind of internalizing these questions while you're going about managing the project, seeing if there are underlying things that may not be coming up, but you are exploring through these different questions using his Scamper method.
Okay, so that's substitute, that's combine.
And then there's adapt. So can you adapt from someone else? Do you like what, there might be other approaches out there dealing with similar things. Maybe someone's written about them, or someone's listened to a webinar or to a conference and you can adapt what they're doing in one industry to your industry.
Mm-hmm.
The M is magnify or emphasize. So how can what you're doing be higher, bigger, stronger, kind of expanding your current methods to take things, to maybe a level that you don't realize is possible. The P is how can I put this to other users? So the difference between a child using it versus an older person, maybe there's geographic differences, kind of exploring new ways for this product or service to be used elsewhere. The E is, what can I eliminate? Or in other words, how do you simplify it? Finally, the R is how can you change, reorder, reverse? So are there any different patterns, layouts, or sequences that maybe you can adjust or see it from a reverse angle that all of a sudden that's the answer to your problem? Flipping something upside down and just looking at it a different way, and that might be the secret to changing the production process or something.
Okay, all right, Scamper, get it. All right, perfect. The other chapter, which I found very unusual, was chapter 12, which talks about giving back. To me, this is a very unusual theme in project management books, I'd say. It's interesting because when we did that, I was just writing a blog article, which is all about mentoring in project management and how, this is one way of giving back. But, what did you mean by it in this book, and why did you include a chapter on it in your book?
I think, yes, mentoring to me is very important. No matter what stage of the project management phase you're in, just beginning, near the end, anything in between, at some point someone has passed a technique down to you or introduced you to somebody. In my case, Ginger Levin coming to me and just going, hey, are you interested in writing a book? To me, that's someone who is established in her career as an author and a project manager, offering, someone just kind of getting introduced to the profession, an opportunity to expand their personal horizons and kind of opening up a new world that person may not have ever even thought of. So I think that passing down, whether it's your knowledge, the mentorship that you're talking about, I think of athletes in their communities where they've made it big, they sort of hit the career lottery in terms of financial success, and even with all that opportunity that they're given, they still go back to their communities, and whether it's a Boys and Girls Club or J.J. Watt is a great example of the NFL. I don't know how prevalent that is in the UK, but
we know what it is. We know what it is.
So he's one of the elite pass rushers in the NFL, and just signed a major deal of $100 million. And this past year, Hurricane Harvey hit the state of Texas, and he plays for the local team there, and he raised $37 million for a relief fund for hurricane victims.
Oh,
so kind
okay.
of that example of, he could have just sat back and had his $100 million and just kind of watched as things happened, but instead he used his platform for a great cause and giving back. So in the project management sense, using a senior position to give someone coming out of college an opportunity to realize similar successes that senior manager has had. It was kind of passing along, and again, the mentorship aspect.
Okay, got it. So, all right, so I get, that's great, but has the book itself led you on to any interesting things? I was told when I wrote my first book that actually, a book is one of the best business cards in the world. So has anything happened to you?
This podcast is more interesting.
Yeah, that wasn't a leading question, listeners.
Well, I will give you credit for it. I guess just for me, it's more of a personal growth thing that's sort of been the interesting path. Throughout high school and college, I was never the one to volunteer to speak in front of the class or offer up my services for any sort of extracurricular group activity. I was very introverted, and this book has sort of led me down the path of public speaking and webinars and writing thousands of words per week and per month, and really sort of expressing myself through the written and oral communication kind of thing. So me, that's been the most interesting path that I've taken. It's more personal. Hopefully at some point, you know, professional opportunities sort of arise and we can go from there. But yeah, just really exploring sort of what I think and getting people to listen to that and respond has sort of been my reward on this book writing path.
But then that's fine. I mean, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that at all. You know, people write for many reasons, and that's just as good a reason as any other. So how do people find out more about you and the book?
So right now I'm writing monthly articles and doing quarterly webinars on projectmanagement.com. I also have a blog. So in my self-naming entrepreneurial project manager, I've sort of combined those words so it's not so wordy into entrepreneur. So just replacing the PRN of entrepreneur with a PM.
Okay, you may have to spell that for listeners just so they can actually find it out. So how do you spell that?
E-N is in Nancy, T-R-E, P-M as in Mary,
mm-hmm.
E-U-R.
Got it. All right, perfect. Okay. And
blog surrounding that, and then if you sign up for the newsletter on that blog, you can get an excerpt of the book we are discussing today. Also on Twitter and Instagram a little bit, sort of using Instagram as like, here are the books I read and the articles I write kind of thing, not too personal in terms of pictures and whatnot. So.
Okay, so there's quite a lot out there for people to go and find. So, and I hope they do. So the book we've been talking about is The Entrepreneurial Project Manager. It's by Chris Cook. Chris, I want to thank you for your time today, and I hope wonderful things happen to you in the future as a result.
Well, thank you. And one last little thing. You can find it on Amazon as well as CRC Press. And if you go to the CRC Press website, I do have a promo code of FLR40. And if you use that on the CRC Press website, you get a 20% discount.
That sounds good. Can you give that code again?
It is FLR40.
All right. Perfect. Well, okay, listeners, there you know. It's lots of ways to find out about Chris, lots of ways to find out the book and get a discount. So it's perfect. Chris, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, there you go. That's the three parts of this podcast. I appreciate your time in listening. I hope you found value in listening to, well, perhaps less myself, but certainly listening to Chris Cook there and Patrick Gleason beforehand. I'm starting out again, new year, and some opportunities coming up, some events coming up. I will be speaking in Dublin in later on in March. And I'll also be heading off to Athens as well in May. I know that. I'm also going, I think it's April, I'm heading off to a UK event in Stevenage with the APM. And some other things on the horizon as well. But, you know, if you have an opportunity or an interest in having someone come along and speak at your internal event or a customer event or whatever it may be, then please bear me in mind. And I know it's been a while, so I'm going to be a little egotistical here and kind of run through my bio again, just in case anybody's come along and who are new to this one. So, you know, I describe myself as a PMO expert because I've built and led five global PMOs across several industries, and I've also advised many other organizations on PMO and PM strategy. I'm an author of a number one best-selling project management book, The Lazy Project Manager, which obviously is the book that gave the name to this podcast. But I've also written many other books on project leadership, PMO development, project marketing, project challenges, executive sponsorship. It's 18 books so far, and I'm currently finishing off my latest book, which is going to be about presentational skills. In the last 5 years, I've delivered over 350 lectures, presentations, whatever you want to call them, speaking events around the world in over 25 countries. And one extremely generous person who I am not related to, the rumor that is my mum who said this, is completely untrue. But I was described as perhaps the most entertaining and inspiring speaker in the project management world today. Very kind gentleman. His mission, or my mission rather, is to teach as many people as possible that it's achievable to work smarter and not harder and still gain success in the battle of the work-life balance. As ever, more information can be found at my website, www.thelazyprojectmanager.com. And of course, through this free podcast on iTunes, why not tell everybody that you know in the project management world all about it? And that's it from me. As ever, please be lazy.
Just stay in bed.